Another illustration of this history is in Revelation 10. And if you have the Ellen White Study Bible, you will find in the bottom of Revelation 10 a comment by Sister White concerning Revelation 10. And in the notes here I have Revelation 10 in my notes. And then from here on, I have the identical comment that's in the Ellen White Study Bible. So simply because of time, I won't read Revelation 10. We're going to go back into Revelation 10, but I'll start by reading Sister White's comments here. The mighty angel, and there's a mighty angel in verses 1 and 2 of Revelation 10 that comes down. The mighty angel who instructed John was no less a personage than Jesus Christ. So the mighty angel that comes down in Revelation 10 is Jesus Christ. Setting his right foot on the sea and his left foot upon dry land shows the part which he is acting in the closing scenes of the great controversy with Satan. We're going to attempt to show you that Revelation 10 is not only the history of the Millerite time period, but Revelation 10 also teaches that that history is to be repeated. And here, Sister White is saying that the angel that comes down in verses 1 and 2, that he puts his foot upon the land and the sea, and this is symbolizing a worldwide message, but also, she's saying this history, this representation of this sacred history, is emphasizing the role of Christ, his participation in this history, whereas the parable of the 10 virgins is emphasizing the experience of the people. Same history, but two avenues, two themes that need to be brought together. Revelation 10 is showing us the role of Christ in this history. So, shows the part which he is acting in the closing scenes of the great controversy with Satan. This position denotes his supreme power and authority over the whole earth. The controversy has waxed stronger and more determined from age to age and will continue to do so to the concluding scenes when the masterly working of the powers of darkness shall reach their height. Satan, united with evil men, will deceive the whole world and the churches who receive not the love of the truth. But the mighty angel demands attention. He cries with a loud voice. He is to show the power and authority of his voice to those who have united with Satan to oppose the truth. After these seven thunders uttered their voices, and to those of you that may have come in, this is Sister White commenting in Revelation 10. After these seven thunders uttered their voices, the injunction comes to John as to Daniel in regard to the little book. Now, brothers and sisters, this paragraph here, let me throw another theme in here. Right here, Sister White's going to talk about the seven thunders in Revelation 10:4, which were sealed up. She's going to do it twice in this passage. But here, she's also going to tie this in to the book of Daniel. Because Daniel chapter 12 is an illustration of the history of the Millerite time period, and it is an illustration of the development of the 144,000. Daniel 12 is a history, the Millerite time period, that is illustrating the history of the 144,000. And in this passage here, Sister White is making one of the arguments for this. Notice what she says. After these seven thunders uttered their voices, the injunction comes to John as to Daniel in regard to the little book. Who's she speaking about here? Daniel, in regard to the little book. Seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered. These relate to future events which will be disclosed in their order. Daniel shall stand in his lot at the end of the days. Where is it that Daniel stands in his lot? End of the days, but where is it in the Bible? That's in history. Where is it in the Bible? It's in Daniel 12, verse 12. She's tying this sealing up of the seven thunders into Daniel 12. And what was there any sealing up in Daniel 12? What was sealed up in Daniel 12? The book of Daniel that was to be unsealed in the time of the end with an increase of knowledge. But here Sister White is telling us, she's wanting us to see that the sealing up of the seven thunders is a type of the sealing up of the book of Daniel in Daniel chapter 12. Okay. These relate to future, the seven thunders relate to future events which will be disclosed in their order. Daniel shall stand in his lot at the end of the days. John sees the little book unsealed. Then Daniel's prophecy have their proper place in the first, second, and third angel's messages to be given to the world. The unsealing of the little book was the message in relation to time. The books of Daniel and Revelation are one. One is a prophecy, the other a revelation, one a book sealed, the other a book opened. John heard the mysteries which the seven thunders uttered, but he was commanded not to write them. The special light given to John, which was expressed in the seven thunders, was a delineation of events that would transpire under the first and second angels' messages. It was not best for the people to know these things, for their faith must necessarily be tested. In the order of God, most wonderful and advanced truths would be proclaimed. The first and second angels' messages were to be proclaimed, but no further light was to be revealed before these messages had done their specific work. This is represented by the angel standing with one foot on the sea, proclaiming with a most solemn oath that time should be no longer. This time, which the angel declares with a solemn oath, is not the end of this world's history, neither a probationary time, but a prophetic time, which should precede the advent of our Lord. That is, the people will not have another message of definite time. After this period of time, reaching from 1842 to 1844, there can be no definite tracing of prophetic time. The longest reckoning reaches to the autumn of 1844. The angel's position with one foot on the sea and the other in the land signifies the wide extent of the proclamation of the message. It will cross the broad waters and be proclaimed in other countries, even to all the world. The comprehension of the truth, the glad reception of the message, is represented by the eating of the little book. The truth in regard to the time of the advent of our Lord was a precious message to our souls. That's what Sister White comments on Revelation chapter 10. And there's a great deal of information that you can parcel out of that passage very carefully in connection with Revelation 10. And that's what we're going to attempt to do here. The one place, Sister White says, that the seven thunders represent a delineation of events that would transpire under the first and second angels' messages. This is the seven thunders now. Sister White here is saying that the seven thunders is the events that transpire, take place, under the first and second angels' messages. In other words, it's the events from August 11, 1840. We just went through that in the previous presentation. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire is where the first angel's message is empowered. From August 11, 1840 until the third angel's message arrived, October 22, 1844. The seven thunders represent a delineation of events that would transpire under the first and second angel's messages. And the second angel's message closes on October 22, 1844. So are we all straight on that understanding? She's saying that the seven thunders represent the history of the Millerite time period, 1840-1844, all right? Be easier for me if we have a common understanding from here on out that when I say 1840, I'm talking about August 11th, 1840, and when I say 1844, I'm saying October 22nd, 1844. That's the history. From 1840 to 1844, these are the specific months and days at the end. That's the events that transpired in the first and second angels' messages. That's the seven thunders. But she also says that it represents future events that will be disclosed in their order. In 1840, we've read it already, Great Controversy 611, August 11th, 1840, the first angel's message is empowered. And she said in Great Controversy 611, the Advent movement of 1840 to 1844 was a glorious manifestation of the power of God. The first angel's message was carried to every mission station in the world. This is one of the events of this history, and the seven thunders is emphasizing events. When she says the seven thunders represent the events that would transpire under the first and second angel's message, she's emphasizing events. And then when she says that the seven thunders represent future events that will be disclosed in her orders, she's saying the seven thunders, whether it's the past history or the future history, it's the events that take place in that history. And there are seven specific events that take place in this history. How many are prepared to nail down the seven events of that history? The other event, the second angel's message we've looked at, arrives June 1842. We've read that in our last presentation. 1843, 1844, the second angel's message is proclaimed. Great Controversy 391, 92, says this: when the time passed at which the Lord's first coming was first expected in the spring of 1844. Now, brothers and sisters, generally with Seventh-day Adventists, we understand there was a disappointment that William Miller was incorrect about his the first time around, correct? And his calculation was what? His 1843. So generally, we think when we talk about the first disappointment, when they realized that they'd made a mistake in 1843, when do we place that in history? 1843. But not so. Because if you want to get technical, the biblical reckoning that the Millerites were using, they allowed for the year 1843 to go all the way into March of 1844. So they were still in March 1844. They were holding out that the Lord was going to return in that year. Were you aware of that? That's a historical fact. That's why Sister White says here, when the time passed at which the Lord's coming was first expected, in the spring of 1844. So in the spring of 1844 is the first disappointment, even though generally we say it was 1843. They were including it could come any place in that year, and the biblical reckoning of a year that they were using began in the spring and ended in the spring. Okay? So that's one of the events there, is the first disappointment. Those who had looked for looked in faith for his appearing were for a season involved in doubt and uncertainty. No one, however, then noticed that an apparent delay in the accomplishment of the vision, a tarrying time, is presented in the same prophecy. After the disappointment, this scripture appeared very significant. Then she quotes Habakkuk. Now, Midnight Cry, August 12th through 17th, Exeter Cap Meeting. That's when it arrived in history. We've already looked at that. Early Writings, page 260, tells us when the second angel's message closes. All heaven watched with deepest interest the reception of the first angel's message, but many who professed to love Jesus and who shed tears as they read the story of the cross, derided the good news of his coming. Instead of receiving the message with gladness, they declared it to be delusion. They hated those who loved his appearing and shut them out of the churches. Those who rejected the first message could not be benefited by the second. Neither were they benefited by the midnight cry, which was to prepare them to enter with Jesus by faith into the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary. And by rejecting the two former messages, they have so darkened their understanding that they can see no light in the third angel's message, which shows the way into the most holy place. The third angel's message arrives here, October 22nd, 1844. That is where the second angel's message closes. When Sister White says the seven thunders represent a delineation of events that would transpire under the first and second angel's message, she's isolating it to this history, August 11th, 1840, to October 22nd, 1844. It's very specifically isolated for us. You know, it's not a general statement. I mean, we're down to the days and the months, not just the years. So, we've read the one where it's the events of that would transpire into the first and second angel's message. In the same passage, she says, Daniel shall stand in his lot at the end of the days. John sees the little book unsealed. Then Daniel's prophecies have their proper place in the first, second, and third angels' messages to be given to the world. The book of Daniel has a specific place in this history where it is located. That's what she's saying. Then Daniel has its proper place. Then Daniel's prophecies have their proper place in the first, second, and third angels' messages to be given to the world. The unsealing of the little book was the message in relation to time. When the book of Daniel was unsealed to the Millerites, it was the message in relation to time. If you haven't looked at the 1843 chart recently, check it out in the hall, and you're going to see it's full of time prophecies and numbers. That's what they were understanding, is the time prophecies in Daniel and Revelation. The message in relation to time, which is what was unsealed for them. In the same passage, it says, Daniel shall stand in his lot at the end of the days, and then dropping down to that end of that paragraph, she says the unsealing of the book was the message in relation to time. There's some kind of element of time that places Daniel in the proper place in this history. That's what you can pull out of this passage. In Testimonies to Ministers, page 115, she says this: Daniel stood in his lot. That's Daniel 12:12. to bear his testimony, which was sealed until the time of the end, when the first angel's message should be proclaimed to our world. So where is it that Daniel stands in his lot in this history? August 11th, 1840. And brothers and sisters, that's what Revelation 10 says. Revelation 10, verses 1 and 2, a mighty angel comes down out of heaven, which is Christ coming down out of heaven, and he has a little book open in his hand. What's that little book? We've read it. It's the book of Daniel. Daniel is positioned right here with a message in relation to time. What's the message in relation to time? I don't think so. You got another shot at it? What message in relation to time places Daniel at August 11th, 1840? Fall of the Ottoman Empire. Fall of the Ottoman Empire is what places him there. The year-day principle of Bible prophecy is connected with what you're saying, but the message in relation to time that places him on August 11th, 1840 is Revelation 9:15, 391 years, 15 days. Daniel stands in his lot when the book is unsealed, when the first angel's message. Okay. So you have to ask the question, and I just did, what time prophecy arrives August 11th, 1840, the time prophecy of Revelation 9:15. Notice this manuscript releases volume 9, page 134. Any question that Satan can arouse in the mind to create doubt in regard to the grand history of the past travels of the people of God will please his satanic majesty and is an offense to God. The tidings of the Lord soon coming in power and great glory to our world is truth. And in 1840, many voices were raised in its proclamation. 1840 is when Daniel stood in his place. He was empowered by the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. How is it that the book of Daniel is empowered, that the book of Daniel stands in its place on August 11th, 1840, in fulfillment of a time prophecy from the book of Revelation? Because that time prophecy in the book of Revelation confirmed the year-day principle, and the message of Daniel, unto 2300 years, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed, is empowered at that point. See the connection? How many see the connection? Okay, please see the connection, because there's reasons to take note of these truths, brothers and sisters. What's going on here, the first angel's message in Revelation 10, Jesus comes down. Verses 1 and 2. Sister White, we read it. This mighty angel that comes down is Christ. He has a book open in his hand, the book of Daniel. He's going to empower the book of Daniel. He's going to put his foot upon the land and the sea, which Sister White tells us is identifying that the empowerment of this message is going to go to the whole world. And it did in 1840. And the same thing we're told is that at this point in time, this is where the book of Daniel is located in this history. This is where Daniel stands in his lot. And Daniel stands in his lot in connection with a time prophecy. And the time prophecy that came to pass is Revelation 9:15, identifying the collapse of an empire that comes out of the bottomless pit. All right? Ottoman Empire came out of the bottomless pit, right? Everyone understand that? It don't look like it. Let's read Revelation 9, verse 2. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and air were darkened by the reason of the smoke of the pit. Brothers and sisters, the pioneer understanding of Revelation 9, verse 2 is that the smoke that comes out of this bottomless pit is Islam. This is the fifth trumpet, the first woe. This is represented by Muhammad. The sixth trumpet, the second woe, is the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is Islam in Turkey. That's the sixth trumpet, the second woe. And the first woe here of Muhammad in Revelation 9:2 is Islam in Arabia. That's pioneer understanding. That's pioneer understanding that, brothers and sisters, is illustrated on the 1843 chart. So Islam In the fifth and sixth trumpet, one of the characteristics of Islam is that it comes out of the bottomless pit. How many powers in the book of Revelation come out of the bottomless pit? Three. Let's turn to Revelation 11, verse 7. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and shall kill them. Who is this power that comes out of the bottomless pit? This is in great controversy. Revelation 11 is dealing with the French Revolution time period, and this is the atheism of France. Atheistic France comes out of the bottomless pit. Revelation 11, verse 7. Revelation 9, verse 2. Islam comes out of the bottomless pit. Revelation 17, verse 8, and we haven't got time to go through it to defend it, but the power that comes out of the bottomless pit in Revelation 17, verse 8 is the papacy. And when Sister White identifies what the bottomless pit represents, she says it's a new manifestation of satanic power. And atheism and Catholicism and Islam are all manifestations of satanic power. Okay? Very quick synopsis. What I want you to see is that when a power from the bottomless pit collapses on August 11, 1840, Jesus, the mighty angel of Revelation 10, verses 1 and 2, comes down out of heaven with the book of Daniel open in his hand, and suddenly Daniel stands in his proper place. He stands in his lot. He stands in this history empowered because the collapse of this power from the bottomless pit has been predicted by the usage of the year-day principle of Bible prophecy, and suddenly the message that Miller's been proclaiming since 1843 is empowered because the year-day principle works. And that's what we read. Sister White says multitudes were convicted of the correctness of the prophetic interpretation of Miller and his associates. That's what empowered it. They understood, hey, he has the right grasp of Bible prophecy. The world's coming to an end. And the message was carried to the world. We really should understand this. This is our heritage. This is our foundation. And all the end time truths will be built upon the foundation. So, if you're going to summarize what Sister White says, the special light given to John, which was expressed in the seven thunders, was the delineation of events that would take place from August 11, 1840 to October 22, 1844. You follow the logic of that. That's what she's saying. Once you understand what the first and angels and second angels' message are historically. But she also says the seven thunders relate to future events that will be disclosed in their orders, in their order. And the Bible teaches that on the mouth of two or three witnesses a thing shall be established. Every word shall be established. That's 2 Corinthians 13:1, and in Genesis 41:32 it says, and for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice. It is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. In manuscript releases, volume 9, page 7 and 8, and we've read these in the first presentation this morning, but we're just going back to them. We're told some prophecies God has repeated, thus showing that importance must be given to them. The Lord does not repeat things that are of no great consequence. And what we're doing here is we've just went through the parable of the 10 virgins and showed that the lesson there is that that history was fulfilled in the Millerite time period, and it's repeated to the very letter at the end of the world. And as we were considering that, we realized that as Sister White is identifying the history of the fulfillment of the parable of the 10 virgins in the pioneer time period, that she's also identifying that the three angels' messages were fulfilled in history. That's what this is. This is Revelation 14. And Revelation 14 is repeated when Revelation 18 is fulfilled. And here we're looking at Revelation 10, which is once again going to show us that this history took place in the Millerite time period, but it's repeated at the end of the world, and the Lord doesn't repeat things that are not of great consequence. Review and Herald, August 19, 1890. This parable of the 10 virgins, has been and will be fulfilled to the very letter. So, I'm not dogmatic about this, but August 11th, 1840, the first angel's message comes into history. June 1842, second angel's message comes into history. In March of 1844, right here, we have the first disappointment. March 1844. And then begins the tarrying time. That's part of the prophecy. That's part of the history that's been identified by inspiration. And then she says, in the summer of 1844, the second angel's message is proclaimed. And then up here, we have the midnight cry, which is another point, one of the events of this history that is specifically identified. And then we have the closing of the door. So I don't know. I think this might be accurate, but it's not something that the opponents of what we teach, if they're going to argue about this one, it's not worth fighting over at this point. I don't know how significant it is, but these are the seven events that take place during the time period that's symbolized by the seven thunders. These are the seven events that inspiration specifically points out. And I think it's worth noting them probably because they have been pointed out. So, let's look at passing over some of these notes. Let's look at Revelation 10 now a little more closely. Revelation 10, verses 1 and 2. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his feet, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea, and his left foot upon the earth, and he cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. Sister White says, this is Christ. Sister White says, this book that's open is the book of Daniel, and the fact that his foot is on the land and the sea is identifying a worldwide message. And he cries as a lion. Do you know any other place where Christ is identified as a lion in the book of Revelation? The Lion of the Tribe of Judah. Where is that? There's only one place in the book of Revelation where he's called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. Turn to Revelation chapter 5. Right, let's start in verse 1. And I saw on the right hand of him that sat upon the throne a book written within and on the backside sealed with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof? And no man in heaven nor earth, neither under the earth, was able to open the book, neither to look thereupon. And I wept much, because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereupon. And one of the elders said unto me, weep not, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof. Now, brothers and sisters, Sister White's clear that the book that's sealed is the Bible. And that it is the Lion of the tribe of Judah that unseals the Bible. In Daniel 12, we're told that the book of Daniel is sealed until the time of the end. When was the book of Daniel sealed, by the way? Let's not go there. The book of Daniel tells us when it was sealed and when it was going to be unsealed. We'll deal with that later, Lord willing. But when it comes time for the book to be unsealed, who does it? Now, Sister White saying has told us, we read it, that commenting on Revelation chapter 10, that in this passage of Scripture, Revelation 10 is emphasizing the role of Christ in this history. And the role of Christ in this history, one of those things, is in verse 3, he cries as a lion. And what does the lion cry out? Well, he cries seven thunders. But John's forbidden to write down what the lion cried out. Who's the lion that's crying? It's the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the one in the Bible that unseals the Bible when it's time for the Bible to be unsealed. Christ takes responsibility. Christ is the one that unsealed the book of Daniel to the Millerites. And at the end of time, Christ will once again unseal a portion of prophecy for his people at the end, for the 144,000. And in verse 3 of Revelation 10, we can go back there now, when we see a lion crying out, and then we see the seven thunders expressed, but John is told to seal them up, the logical conclusion is this has a direct relationship with the Lion of the tribe of Judah who has prevailed to unseal the book. He's the one that at some point in time is going to unseal the seven thunders. And we know from Revelation 22 when that takes place. It takes place just before human probation closes. So that's Revelation 10 takes us from this history down to the sealing up. And then in verse 5, Christ, we've already looked at verse 4, he lifts up his hand to heaven and he swears by him that liveth forever and ever. This is verse 6, who created heaven and the things that are therein, and the earth and the things that are therein, and the sea, the things that are therein, that should each time no longer. Brothers and sisters, Sister White is crystal clear, and it's unfortunate the Seventh-day Adventists can't take this in its simplicity. Time prophecies came to a conclusion on October 22nd, 1844. There is no day-for-a-day application of time prophecy at the end. We have no new message. We're to continue to present the things that brought the people out of the churches in 1843 and 1844, which is illustrated on the 1843 chart, and the 1335 and the 1290 of Daniel chapter 12 are illustrated on that chart. And they were fulfilled, according to the pioneers, in 1798, the 1290, and in 1843, the 1335. And Daniel 12:11 says, blessed is he who cometh to the 1335 days. And the pioneers understood that to be 1843. And Revelation, what does Revelation say? It says, blessed is he who is called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And brothers and sisters, in 1843, you've reached the history where those people in the Millerite movement in the 1843 time period, where were they heading? They were heading into the marriage. There's no more blessed time in history. And that's what the pioneers said, that the blessing that took place in 1843 had to be that. They didn't nail that down the way I just did. But it was in connection with the marriage. No more time prophecies. That's what Revelation 10 is teaching us. Verse 7, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. The pioneers correctly identified that the sounding of the seventh angel began when? This was the subject of pioneer writing. They dealt with this. We're not familiar with it. When did the sounding of the seventh trumpet begin?
1844.
October 22nd, 1844. You know what the mystery of godliness here that is being referred to in the sounding of the seventh trumpet is referring to? The mystery of godliness is Christ and is the hope of glory. But this particular aspect of the mystery of godliness, it's not emphasizing simply the experience of the incarnation, the mystery of Christ in us, the hope of glory. You know what this is dealing with? The development of the 144,000. The sounding of the seventh trumpet is identifying the time period when the 144,000 are developed. And when is it that the 144,000 are developed? They're developed during the time period that we call the antitypical Day of Atonement, during the investigative judgment. The sounding of the seventh trumpet is the time period from October 22nd, 1844 until the close of human probation. That's how the pioneers understood it. And they were correct in that understanding. So what I want you to see, if you will, is in verses 1 and 2 of Revelation 10, Christ comes down out of heaven on August 11, 1840. And by verse 7, we're in October 22, 1844. There's the history of the Millerite time period very specifically nailed down, and that's how the pioneers understood it. And then in verse 8, it drops back into that history. Verses 1 through 7 have covered this history. And not only have they covered that history, they put a little mystery in there with the seven thunders that was sealed up. And the seven thunders that was sealed up, what was it? It was this history. So there's a double emphasis on this history in the first seven verses of Revelation 10. Do you follow my logic? So when you get to verse 8, notice what verse 8 says. And the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again and said, go take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel which standeth on the sea and upon the earth. This is taking us back where? To verses 1 and 2. It's saying, okay, the angel come down in verse 1 and 2 with the little book open in his hand. His foot upon the sea, his foot upon the water, the land. Now in verse 8, he tells John, okay, go over to the angel and take the little book. Take the little book. So it goes right back into that history. Goes back to right here. Right? Took the little book that was open right at the beginning of this history. And then in verse 9 it says, and I went unto the angel and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said unto me, take it and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. Now, as Seventh-day Adventists, we know that one, don't we? What was that? That was the Millerite movement. that they took the message from the book of Daniel from the angel's hand here in this time period. It was sweet in their mouth. But when they got to this history, they just covered this history. This is the second time. The third, if you count the seven thunders. This is the third time in Revelation 10 that this history has been passed over. You follow my logic? Well, verses 1 through 7 takes you from the angel coming down until the sounding of the seventh trumpet. And then in verse 8 it says, okay, go back over here to verses 1 and 2 and take that book out of that angel's hand and eat it, sweet in your mouth, but here it's bitter in your stomach. Follow the logic? That's what we're talking about is this history. Now notice the next verse. And he said unto me, thou must prophesy again. Brothers and sisters, what is that saying? This history gets repeated again. It gets repeated. That's what it's saying. Now, if this is the only place in the Bible where you had a verse like that, it would be a stretch. But when you've already had Sister White saying the parable of the 10 virgins has been and will be fulfilled to the very letter, and she says the seven thunders represent the events that transpire under the first and second angel's message, and they relate to future events that will be disclosed in their order, and she associates that history with the three angels' messages coming into history in this time period, and then ties that history in with the fourth angel's message. And brothers and sisters, here in verse 11, when it says you have to do this again, it's teaching us that this history is repeated to the very letter. So, one of the things about this study, maybe it can be emphasized too much, I don't know, but to me it doesn't seem like it can be, but this is my human perspective. Go to verse 4 one more time, if you would, of Revelation 10. Start in verse 3. And cried with a loud voice as when a lion roareth. And we're suggesting that this is the lion of the tribe of Judah, the one in the Bible that is identified as being capable of unsealing the Bible when the appropriate time to unseal the Bible arrives. And he cried with a loud voice, it's when a lion roareth, and when he cried, seven thunders uttered their voices, and when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. Brothers and sisters, in this time period, the Millerite time period, the book of Daniel was unsealed. Correct? But this history is going to be repeated again at the end of the world. So is it a stretch to suggest that something will be unsealed at the end of the world? And in the very passage in Revelation where the emphasis is placed on where the book of Daniel comes in and joins the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 10, in Revelation chapter 10 is where we have the passage that is sealed up, the seven thunders. Is it such a stretch to say that at the end of the world, that once again there's going to be an unsealing, and the unsealing is going to be the seven thunders? Do you see the logic? Go with me to Revelation 22 one more time. Start in verse 6. And he said unto me, these sayings are faithful and true. And the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show unto her servants things which must shortly be done. Behold, I come quickly. Blessed is he that keepeth the sayings of the prophecy of this book. And I, John, saw these things, and I heard them. And when I had heard and seen, I fell down to worship before the feet of the angel which showed me these things. Then saith he unto me, see thou do it not, for I am thy fellow servant and of thy brethren the prophets, and of them which keep the sayings of the book, worship God. What's the emphasis here? What's one of the emphases in these verses? Is that the people that are correct here are going to be keeping what? The sayings of this book, right? You see that in there? And then verse 10 says, and he saith unto me, seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still. He which is filthy, let him be filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him be righteous still. And he that is holy, let him be holy still. Brothers and sisters, just before the close of probation, the Lion of the tribe of Judah unseals the prophecy in Revelation that has been sealed up. That's the seven thunders. The fact that we are starting to understand these things is proof that probation's about to close. What do we got to do? We got to keep the sayings of the prophecy of this book. How are we going to keep them if we don't know them? We need to become students of prophecy at this point in Earth's history. Like the Millerites were. Evangelism, page 195. The book of Revelation must be open to the people. Many have been taught that it is a sealed book, but it is sealed only to those who reject light and truth. The truth it contains must be proclaimed that the people may have opportunity to prepare for the events which are soon to transpire. The third angel's message must be presented as the only hope for the salvation of a perishing world. Signs of the Times, January 11, 1899. The Revelation is a sealed book. But it is also an open book, recording marvelous events that are to take place in the last day of this earth's history. Its teachings are definite, not mystical and unintelligible. And God would have us understand it. Let me show you one thing in our remaining moments, if you will. We've already dealt with this a little bit. Some of you will not follow this, unfortunately. But it's time to step fast, all right? There's prophetic truths that have been out there for 10 years, and you can't go back over the same old ground every time. So if I lose you here, we may have to do a little extra work afterwards to bring you up to speed. The fourth angel's message of Revelation 18 is two parts, part A, part B, whatever you want to identify with. How many were here for the last presentation? So I don't need to go over that again, right? Verses 1 through 3, a mighty angel comes down out of heaven, lightens the earth with his glory. But in verse 4, there's another voice, all right? So it's part A, part B, however you want to express it. The first angel's message was what? A mighty angel that came down out of heaven that lightened the earth with his glory, correct? So to draw a parallel between the angel that comes down in Revelation 10 and the angel that comes down in Revelation 18, that's not too much of a stretch, correct? Especially when Sister White told us, as we read last time, that the third angel's message is to parallel the first and second angel's message. And the fourth angel's message is simply the final fulfillment of the third angel's message. It's when the third angel's message swells to a loud cry. So, the first part of Revelation 18 is worldwide, and the second part is the loud cry of the third angel's message, which Sister White's clear takes place at the Sunday Law. But, the first angel's message, brothers and sisters, came into history when a power from the bottomless pit was brought down. What was the power from the bottomless pit that was brought down on August 11, 1840? Ottoman Empire came from bottomless pit. Revelation 9, verse 2. But you know something in our day and age? There's been a power from the bottomless pit that was brought down. And verse 7 says, atheism come from the bottomless pit. And in 1989... the modern king of atheism, the king of the South, came down in fulfillment of Daniel 11, verse 40. And brothers and sisters, the whole world seen it happen. The only people that did not see it happen were Seventh-day Adventists, because Seventh-day Adventists were required, as Seventh-day Adventists, to see the spiritual implications of this collapse, and we didn't. But the reality there is that the dynamics were the same. Once again, a power from the bottomless pit came down in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Daniel 11, verse 40. That's the first part of Revelation 18, verses 1 through 3. It's a worldwide manifestation. Now, what's the second part of Revelation 18, verses 4? It's a loud cry. It's localized. Where is it localized? Where is the loud cry localized? United States. It's a Sunday law in the United States. Brothers and sisters, what's the next verse in Daniel 11? It's verse 41, and I know there's people verses 1 through 5. And it's telling us that this history that began on August 11th in 1840 for the pioneer time period began for us here in 1989, 17 years ago. And the next thing to happen is verse 41, a Sunday law in the United States. Daniel 11, verse 40, describes the war between the king of the south and the king of the north. It says, and at the time of the end, and the time of the end is 1798, shall the king of the south, in Daniel 11, the king of the south is the power that controls Egypt. But in this time period, you're not looking for the power that controls Egypt. You're looking for the power that controls spiritual Egypt. Revelation 11, verse 8, identifies the beast that comes out of the bottomless pit in the previous verse as atheistic France. And the two characteristics of atheistic France is that it's the great city of Sodom and Egypt. Egypt representing atheism, Sodom representing licentiousness. In 1798, Daniel 11, verse 40, the time of the end, the king of the south, atheism, was to push. The Hebrew word push in the verse means war against. We begin a war against the king of the north. The pioneers understood. James White defended to his dying day that the king of the north in Daniel 11 was the papacy, and he was correct. Verse 40 of Daniel 11 is saying that in 1798, atheistic France would begin a war against the papacy. But in time, the verse says, the papacy would return and sweep away the king of the south, the king of atheism. And when that took place, there was a different king of the south. It was no longer atheistic France. It was the Soviet Union. And in 1989, by an alliance between the United States and the Vatican, as represented in the verse itself, the chariots, ships, and horsemen are identified in the United States. Chariots and horsemen in Bible prophecy represent military strength. Ships represent economic strength. The papacy never has its own army. The fact that verse 40 says chariots, ships, and horsemen were going to come with the king of the north is identifying an end-of-the-world ally to the papacy that supplies two things, military and economic strength. That's Revelation 13. Because in Revelation 13, the United States has two horns. The beginning of the United States, those two horns represent republicanism and Protestantism. Not so when it's speaking as a dragon. You're not a republic or a Protestant when you're speaking as a dragon. At the end of the world, the two horns of strength for the United States are military and economic strength. Can't buy or sell if you don't have the mark of the beast. Economics. Put to death if you don't have the mark of the beast. Military. Verse 40 of Daniel 11 is identifying the alliance between the United States and the Vatican that took place in the Ronald Reagan years and brought down the King of the South in 1989, and Adventism was required to understand and proclaim that to the world, and they've slept on. Verse 41 is identifying a Sunday law in the United States. This history parallels Revelation 18, verses 1 through 5 perfectly. It parallels the first and second angel's message perfectly. It agrees with the pioneer history perfectly. And brothers and sisters, probation's about to close. Question? Seven thunders. First angel's message, second angel's message, first disappointment. Spring. I mark March 21st, 1844. That's the first disappointment. And then begins the tarrying time. That's part of Habakkuk. It's part of the parable of the 10 virgins. It's identified by the spirit of prophecy. Then Sister White's very specific to say that in the summer of 1844, the second angel's message was proclaimed. This is when it was proclaimed. It arrived here, but it's proclaimed here. And then August 1844, the midnight cry. All these are different events, but they're specifically pointed out. And then October 22nd, 1844, the second angel's message closes.
Did Lewis and Beer point out the...
Yes. In the 1950s, it had been, just like Josiah Litch pointed it out in advance, Louis Weir, an Australian pastor who's now deceased, wrote a tract and pointed out that in the very near future, the Soviet Union is going to be brought down through an alliance between the Vatican and the Protestant powers in fulfillment of Daniel 11, verse 40. We knew it in advance, but we were Laodiceans. Josiah Litch and the Millerites were Philadelphians.
Yeah,
some people say the most important rule in Bible prophecy is before the cross, literal. After the cross, symbolic, spiritual, however you want to express it. This rule of Bible prophecy, it's nailed down in the New Testament very clearly. Paul teaches that a Jew before the time period of the cross was a literal blood descendant of Abraham. A Jew after the time period of the cross is a descendant of Abraham by faith. There's a change prophetically that takes place during the time period of the cross. This rule of Bible prophecy is the rule that every Protestant reformer used to identify the Pope of Rome as the Antichrist of Bible prophecy. The papacy knew this, and in the Counter-Reformation it assigned the work to a couple of its most able scholars to invent rules of Bible prophecy that destroyed this rule. And if you go back to the 19th century, you will see Protestants making fun of these Catholic rules that were invented to destroy this rule. Because this rule identifies who the Pope of Rome is. He's the Antichrist. But in the beginning of the 20th century, a new Bible was printed called the Scofield Bible, which incorporated these Catholic rules of prophetic interpretation into the footnotes of that Bible, and the Trojan horse was in the Christian church. And from that time period on, confusion has arisen about these rules of Bible prophecy. But this is one rule of Bible prophecy that has a history associated with it that is confirmed in Christianity. And the rule is simply this. Prophecy that's fulfilled before the time period of the cross is understood in its literal application. The king of the south, before the time period of the cross, is going to be a literal geographical area. But after the time period of the cross, when you're looking for the king of the south, you're not looking for literal Egypt, you're looking for spiritual Egypt. And Revelation 11, verse 8, identifies spiritual Egypt. And Revelation 17 identifies spiritual king of the north, spiritual Babylon, as the papacy. Daniel 11, verse 40.
What about the existence of atheism in the United States? We seem to be involved in an ever-escalating, this morning, in this morning's paper, a second event has come out where the atheism is attacking, you know, the Protestant politicians. You're having warfare kind of going on here. Is this part of this conflict too? Atheism against, or...
Yeah, it definitely all part of the great controversy, but it's not really directly related to the prophetic information that we're sharing at this time. In fact, when I said I might lose some of you here, it was because I was going to go into Daniel 11, and I know that some of you have not ever looked at, possibly have not looked at Daniel 11. So I know there's a lot of background that you're probably not familiar with, and I maybe should not have went there. That's probably a little too far out of the subject at hand. So if there's questions, either on Daniel 11 on a minor way or on the repeat of this history in a major way, let's raise those questions here. You.
In Daniel 11, where is it? Is it verse 40 where Egypt? No, yeah. Is... the king of the south, either literal or spiritual. And then in verse 42, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, and that's all the world. I don't completely understand that.
Okay. I probably shouldn't have went there. I opened maybe a can of worms. But I'm not afraid of the question. But I wanted those of you that have looked at Daniel 11, 40 to 45, before we part today, I want you to see the Revelation 18, verses 1 through 5, corresponds with Daniel 11, verses 40 and 41, and it corresponds with the first and second angel's message. Okay, I needed to nail that down to try to put some conviction on your heart, but that's the Holy Spirit's work. Maybe I shouldn't have did that. So we went to Daniel 11. And in Daniel 11, for I don't know where we're all at on Daniel 11. When we go through Daniel 11, it usually takes 10 hours to go through Daniel 11, 40 to 45. And if you haven't ever looked at it before, there's a whole lot of background that needs to go into looking at those last six verses of Daniel 11. But here's how it goes. And you can find this in the book Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith. I point you to that book, not because I agree with everything in that book, but because Sister White says that every Seventh-day Adventist should own that book, and she says it's God's helping hand. And when Uriah Smith, in agreement with the Pioneer Understanding, is dealing with Daniel chapter 11, because Daniel chapter 11 is the only place where you see the war between the King of the South and the King of the North. That's the only place in Scripture where this war takes place. Uriah Smith points out correctly that the power that controls Egypt in Daniel 11 is the King of the South, and the power that controls Syria. That's the terminology of Uriah Smith. But in modern prophetic understanding, Babylon was in Syria. The power that controls Babylon is the King of the North. But that's the rule that's established internally in Daniel 11 and the history that was confirmed by Daniel 11. When a power in Daniel 11 is controlling the geography of Egypt, it is identified in Daniel 11 as the King of the South. When a power is controlling Babylon, that power is, in Daniel 11, that power is controlled the King of the North. And Uriah Smith correctly points out that as history progresses, different powers controlled Egypt and different powers controlled Babylon. So who the King of the South and who the King of the North is changes as history moves forward. So when you come to Daniel 11, verse 40, you have the King of the South and the King of the North, and you have to use this rule. You're not looking for literal Egypt, literal Babylon. You're now looking for spiritual Egypt, spiritual Babylon. The time of the end in verse 40, in Great Controversy, page 356, Sister White says the time of the end is 1798. So verse 40 is saying, in 1798, the King of the South, the power that controls spiritual Egypt, will begin a war against the power that controls spiritual Babylon. Revelation 17, spiritual Babylon, 1798 time period, the papacy. Revelation 11, verse 8, the power that controls spiritual Egypt in the 1798 time period, atheistic France. And sure enough, in 1798, the time of the end, France delivered the deadly wound to the papacy. You want to know where the deadly wound to the papacy is identified in the Scriptures? It's Daniel 11, verse 40. That's where the history is nailed down in that verse. We should understand this, even though we don't. So the question is, how is it that in verse 42... after the King of the South is conquered in verse 40, and after the glorious land is conquered in verse 41, suddenly the King of the North isn't going to conquer the King of the South, he's going to conquer Egypt. There is a very close relationship between Egypt and the King of the South, but Daniel makes a distinction. The first thing to nail down is Daniel identifies the King of the South in verse 40, and that's the power that controls Egypt, but Daniel identifies Egypt in verses 42 and 43. So I don't deny that there isn't a close relationship, but I do insist that Daniel made a distinction. So what is the distinction? Egypt, in the prophetic scenario, the prophetic sequence of events here, after the Soviet Union collapses in verse 40, the next point of conquest for the papacy is the glorious land, which is the United States, and is a Sunday law. And Sister White is clear that first the Sunday law comes to the United States, then every country on the globe follows her example. More often than not, in prophecy, Egypt symbolizes the world. And in verses 42 and 43, it's talking about all the countries of the world. And this is just what Sister White says. First the United States, the glorious land, verse 41. Then every country on the globe, Egypt. So once you see the sequence and you're settled in that, then you can ask yourself, what is the relationship between Egypt and the King of the South? And the relationship is a little bit, takes a little bit of time, but we have 5 minutes. Brothers and sisters, we are the people that have been called by God to give the fourth angel's message. And the fourth angel's message comes in two parts. The first part is a description of Babylon, verses 1 through 3 of Revelation 18. The next two verses is the call out of Babylon. If we are the men and women that are to give the description of Babylon and then call people out of them, then we should be the experts on modern Babylon. And modern Babylon in Bible prophecy comes in three parts. According to Revelation 16, it's the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet. And you may wonder how I'm going to get back to the King of the South in Egypt, but I'm going to. Give me a second. Each of these three players have their own characteristics unto themselves. The beast is Rome, papacy. Rome never changes, correct? In history, in prophecy, Rome never changes. But the false prophet changes. This is an easy way to see that each of these powers have their own characteristics unto themselves. If you look at the story of the three Elijahs, a very simple story, brothers and sisters, this book points out that when, after the great disappointment, those people that followed on in faith, they had to come to grips with what happened on October 22nd, 1844, and they had to find out who they were as God's people. You know what the first conclusion they came to was, according to this book, and I think it's accurate, is that they were the modern Elijah. The Adventist Church, from the very foundation, we've understood that we're the third Elijah, one way or another. Some people will say Ellen White's the third Elijah. Some people will say the Advent people are the third Elijah. I'm not going to argue that point. All I'm saying is that we've understood from the very beginning that we are the Elijah people, and we are. Brothers and sisters, there's three Elijahs. The first Elijah was Elijah. And who did Elijah deal with? He dealt with a threefold prophet, a threefold power, Jezebel. And she was married to Ahab. And the prophets of Baal did the dance of deception. The beast, impure woman, in an unlawful relationship with a king, a civil power, and a deceiving power. Very simple to see. This is simple, right? Elijah represents God's people at the end of the world that don't die. But John the Baptist, the second Elijah, he had the same threefold power to deal with. Herodias, impure woman, in an unlawful relationship with a civil power. Same story. And Salome does the dance of deception. The same story. First Elijah, second Elijah put together give you the characteristics of the third Elijah, you and I at the end of the world. If we're faithful, we're either going to be Elijah and live till Jesus returns, or we're going to be John the Baptist and be resurrected in the special resurrection just before Jesus returns. But we are going to do conflict with these three powers. And each of these powers have their own characteristics unto themselves. And in the story of two Elijahs, the three Elijahs, you see that one of the characteristics of this power is that it's an impure woman, a corrupt church. The dragon power is a civil power. A civil power. That's why Sister White says in Testimonies to Ministers, page 38, kings, governors, and rulers have taken upon themselves the brand of Antichrist and are represented as the dragon who goes to make war against the saints. In the Sunday Law time period, the dragon power is a group, plural, of civil authorities, kings, governors, and rulers. Testimonies of Ministers, page 38. And of course, the false prophet of the United States forces the world to accept this unlawful marriage between the United Nations and the papacy. All right? There's a lot of evidence to bring to bear, but here's what I want you to see. Each of these powers have their own characteristics unto themselves. In the story of Elijah, you just see one aspect of it. There are other aspects of it. One of them is this. The papacy is seated in the city of Rome from the beginning until the end. When was the papacy given the city of Rome? The year 330. Constantine moved the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople, and it had given the papacy its seat. Revelation 13:2 says the dragon gave the papacy its power, its seat, and its great authority. It gave its power from 496 to 508. Gave its seat in the year 330. It gave its authority in the year 533. The papacy seated in Rome all the way to Revelation 17, when the 10 kings burn her with fire and destroy her flesh, because in verse 9, she set it upon the seven-hill city of Rome. She stays there from beginning to end. The United States begins in the United States. It ends in the United States. It changes, but it's always in the United States. The dragon is different. The dragon is different. The dragon begins, the dragon power begins on the plains of Shinar with Nimrod. And it's there in Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. But at the fall of Babylon, the religious elite of Babylon, where did they go to? Pergamos. That's what Revelation says, where Satan's seat is. So it moves from Babylon to Pergamos. And what was the custom of pagan Rome that won pagan Rome the title of pagan Rome? There was a characteristic of Rome that the pioneers understand, identified, that historians identified, when pagan Rome conquered a city or a nation, if there was a pagan worship style that that city or nation was using, then the Romans would take the relics of that worship and the priest, and they would bring them back to the city of Rome, and they would build a new compartment in the Pantheon temple so that religion could continue on. And it's that practice that pagan Rome used to exalt paganism. That's why we call pagan Rome, pagan Rome. So when Pergamus was conquered by the Romans, what did the Romans do? They took the religion of the Chaldeans that had moved from Babylon to Pergamus, and they took it to the city of Rome. So the dragon, it doesn't stay in one place. It begins in Babylon, it moves to Pergamus, it goes to the city of Rome, and it ends up in pagan Rome, and pagan Rome disintegrates into 10 kingdoms. One of those kingdoms is atheistic France, so it's moving. It moves to France, it ends up in the Soviet Union, still a manifestation of the Soviet Union, or of the Empire of Europe. And brothers and sisters, at the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the King of the South came down, and now I'm getting to your answer, in 1989, when the Soviet Union collapsed, who was the leader of the Soviet Union? And what did Mikhail Gorbachev do at that point in time when he lost his job? He transferred to the United Nations. The dragon power moves through history. And so there is a close relationship between the King of the South and Egypt, but there's a distinction by Daniel. The final manifestation of the dragon power is the United Nations. And that's a lot. Brothers and sisters, we have a 40-hour prophecy school where we nail this stuff down, and I believe it's worth understanding. But this week, what we're wanting to emphasize, and it's not there any longer, is that the pioneer time period is repeated to the very letter at the end of the world. And when you look closely at the characteristics of that time period, you see where we're at today, and we're at the very edge of the close of probation.
You might want to mention that that whole study you have in DVD and audio tape.
Yes, that's the 40-hour prophecy school. In the study that we're doing here, when we came to understand what we're sharing here, and we're just getting started, we purposely recorded it in two parts. In Idaho about a month and a half ago, and then last week in Blythe, California. And so that will be available on DVD, DVD video as well, plus whatever they're recording here. Sister in the back.
Yes,